part of it was because the complex nature of the case and all the details that I think are so important made me concerned about whether or not this case would get the due consideration that it deserved. We were concerned about addressing things in a way that, you know, perhaps just the general public would be readily able to follow what was going on in the case. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized how important it is and how reassuring it is that we are arguing the case before the public. The fact that we would bring Court of Appeals proceedings to a place where it wouldn't normally be heard is another indication of the judicial process that we value and the framework that we find so important, which is the right to a public trial, which is that we don't do anything in secret. And based on that, and in particular because I think it's an important issue in this brief anyway, but it seems not lost on me that the first point of error in this case is that very denial of the right to have the public present during what I consider to be a crucial phase of the trial. So when we're talking about the right to exclude or the exclusion of the public from the trial, in Harrison, Ryan had his mom and his grandmother and a friend who wanted to be present during selection of the jury, during the voir dire proceeding.
And Ryan is the defendant.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he's the one charged with having murder.
That is correct.
And he was, at the time of the trial, 18 years old, or at the time of the offense?
At the time of the trial, he was 19.
Okay.
Yes. And he had his grandmother and his mother and a friend with him and wanted to have them present in the courtroom. And what happened was the trial court decided that there wasn't enough space for the family to be in the courtroom.
Well,
and
in fact, the trial court didn't just decide there wasn't enough space. There wasn't enough space. There was no space behind the bar, am I correct?
There was no space in the seats and the benches in the gallery.
Okay.
There were actual places in the courtroom, actually in the gallery. The way the configuration is set up, and I talked about
it.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's not the way I read the record. You're telling me it's in the record that there was places behind the bar.
What I actually articulated in the bill is that there were areas in the aisle and next to some of the seating where you could have set up folding chairs for people to be able to sit.
Right by the narrow thing.
Yes, that's correct. There were also places on the other side of the bench in the, what I'm going to call the courtroom proper. And then additionally, there was the jury box. And although not required, and one of the things I actually want to point out about this that I think is important to examine in the context of it, is that this is not like it was a surprise. This is not a situation where we find out years later in some habeas corpus proceeding that some sheriff accidentally locked the door, or there was some inadvertent thing where people were excluded from the courtroom. We're talking about the purposeful exclusion when it's brought to the court's attention that that's what's going to happen, and that the denial of the right to a public trial is going to be foreclosed by excluding those people from the voir dire. One of the things that I think is important to consider is that it wasn't a surprise to anybody. We told the court, we gave the court a copy of the case, Preston versus Georgia, and said, you know what? This is what you have to do. This is what we're supposed to do. This is the law that governs the proceedings that we follow. We gave a copy to the state. And I believe there was no attempt to follow the factors of Waller or Presley at all.
And what do you do about that? Other than you don't like it.
I'm sorry.
What do you do about United States of America versus Gupta? Other than you don't like it.
Well, I think first off, one of the biggest problems with Gupta, and it is a second circuit opinion, there are no precedents out of the Fifth Circuit or the United States Supreme Court, which holds the way Gupta does with this triviality, which, trust me, I have plenty I'd like to say about that. I think that Gupta is distinguishable on its facts, even. In particular, it was one of those habeas corpus proceedings where it came to the attention later that there was some sort of inadvertent closure of the courtroom. The other thing is you will find that in Gupta, when they talk about the precedents in Gupta, they talk about most instances where there was a limited closure, not a closure for the entire voir dire, or where the closure was inadvertent. And I think that's also a distinguishing factor. However, I don't think we have to get to any of that, because it seems to me that when the, when Gupta applies this triviality analysis, then what they're really doing is applying a harm analysis. And it's obvious because what they say is fact-specific analysis of unique circumstances of the case to determine if the core values are implicated. That's the evaluation that they're performing. That is a harm analysis. And so structural errors are not errors. They're so few and far between of what we recognize anyway. But structural errors are not errors that are supposed to be subject to that sort of evaluation. Structural error is an error that renders the entire proceeding so fundamentally unfair and unreliable a vehicle for determining guilt or innocence that were we to start trying to evaluate the effect of the deprivation, that we would cast a doubt on the fairness and integrity and the public reputation of the judicial proceedings altogether.
So are you telling me that the fact that mom and friend weren't there during Boy Dyer is of such a consequence that it taints the whole proceeding, it makes the whole thing unfair, whatever verbiage that you just used, that dog doesn't seem to hunt, not off the top of my head?
But that's what the Supreme Court said,
in Presley, and actually, I mean, Waller's really set forth kind of what the determination is as to whether they close it. But in Presley, they said, yes, we recognize this as an applicable right during Boyd Dyer, and in fact, they said it's a structural error.
And so if he wanted 45 people to come in the courtroom, and the courtroom could only get 40, well, sorry, structural error.
No.
I mean, where's the line drawn here?
Sure. And I understand that. And I can understand that that's always a concern in any trial, whether it's a Boyd Dyer proceeding or whether it's some other aspect of the trial. But the notion is that if we allow people in, and in particular a defendant's family and friends, which, you know, the court talks impressively about the fact of how important it is for you to be able to have that support when you're talking about a 19-year-old who's facing life in prison or in some instances
death. We're not talking about the trial. We're talking about picking the jury. Where his lawyer is the one that's doing the talking, his lawyer's there for him, his lawyer's there representing him, and then they are during the trial to support him as you use the word.
Where do we stop? I mean, it's a slippery slope. If the whole notion is, that it's not having the proceedings in secret that's important, if it's making sure that the core values of the Sixth Amendment are fulfilled, that it is a fair trial, that the prosecutor's doing his job or her job, that the judge is doing his or her job. If the notion is that we are protecting that framework, then to then go and try and pick apart, well, this part of the trial is not important, to me, flies in the face of giving it the importance that it's entitled to via the Constitution and everything that we recognize about not holding proceedings.
Well, in picking a jury, wouldn't it be also important, and I did not see this discussed in the cases or the briefs, that perhaps the mother and aunt or grandmother and a friend could have assisted the attorney in perhaps recognizing someone?
Yeah, that is absolutely right. I'm so glad you asked that because I had it in my notes, but you know, you rarely get to everything in your notes. One of the things that I would say is that in trials that I have done personally, I have had experiences where family members have been sitting behind the veneer, and not only are they the eyes and ears, another set of eyes and ears to hear and see things that sometimes we miss as trial attorneys when we're busy talking to people, but they also pick up on the things that we don't get to hear because of where jurors are seated. I've had jurors whisper things to each other that they didn't tell to the judge. I've had jurors say, I just don't like her. And a family member's come and said, that juror hates your guts. Well, that's something important that we would want to know. And I think certainly anytime you have people in there that can assist, not just the attorneys, but also when you select in or exclude people in a veneer, you consult with the client. And the client a lot of times leans on their family for support as to what sorts of decisions that they want to make
Counselor Hall,
There was none. There was none. And in fact, if you read the entire transcript, I'm sure the court has, there's no evidence throughout the trial of any incidents, anything to justify any additional security concerns. And up at the time of the exclusion, which I think is where we're going with justice, and so I don't mean to divert to something else, but at the time of the exclusion, there was no evidence that there was any problem. And I think what's really important about what you just said is when the trial court actually originally excluded, and we came back in and said, we want him back in here, the only thing the trial court said was there's not enough space. The trial court did not delineate any security concern. The trial court said, there's not room, and the state, who I think was complicit in it, said, well, the gallery's full, the gallery's full. Then we started to try and make suggestions about things to do with our family members or the public who might wish to view the proceedings, including our suggestion of putting them in the jury box, which was also a suggestion made in the Presley case. That suggestion was not required of us. I mean, I think that it's a good practice for the defense to try and make sure that we're really seeking to obtain what we're objecting to, the rights that we want to protect, that we're actually trying to get those rights, which is what we did try and do. We said, we want to put them in the jury box. And it was in response to that, the state said, I would then want to put the victim's family members in the jury box, and I think it would be dangerous for them to sit so closely together. Keeping in mind that victims' families and defendants' families and other individuals are oftentimes in the gallery seated close to each other. A lot of times they try and kind of pick a side, but especially in the case where the gallery is full, it's oftentimes that they're sitting next to each other.
So the victims' family members are allowed to stay in the courtroom during the court
hearing? The record does not reflect that if the victims' family members were even there. The statement from the state was, we want them here. There was no testimony, there's no bill or anything that indicated that they were actually there. We also suggested that the the last number of jurors who were seated on the opposite side of the bar, we suggested that they be moved to the jury box so that then that would free up a row in the gallery so we wouldn't have the security concern that the state, that the judge articulated in the bill later, that we wouldn't have any issues with the juror, the family sitting next to each other, that we wouldn't have any issues with jurors, with the family being up in the gallery proper, in the courtroom proper. And so there was an articulation of that as well, which we didn't have to do. Importantly, there was no articulation of an overriding interest by the state, or by the judge, which is what was said. When I was discussing the fact that all they said was closing the courtroom doors. There was also no consideration on the record of any other options. The judge didn't talk about going to the ceremony of the courtroom. The judge didn't talk about dividing the panel in two. The judge didn't articulate that we could consider putting people, some of the denier in that box. And that is required by law. They have to make those findings and they have to articulate them on the record. The trial court didn't do it, even though it had the Presley case and the Waller factors in front of it in order to make that determination. And I think that is critical. And even though we came back and said other suggestions and alternatives, both at the time of the request and in the bill later when we were trying to clarify with the record how the configuration was, even though we came back and made those suggestions, we weren't required to. The court needed to do that on its own, and it didn't. And I believe that is something that is not just what the law says, but obviously something that needs to be considered in what the court's intent was and what the court was concerned about the case.
And what relief are you asking?
Well, on that point, reverse and remand for a new trial. There are other points there in the brief that are
18 of them.
I believe so, Your Honor.
Counselor Moore, there is a discussion of the provision for abandoning the fire of the connection between the walls that are issued and information obtained in conjunction with the walls. And how does that operate to the information that was ultimately obtained from the subpoena service? Now, I understand clearly whether in
I tried to clarify that a little bit in the reply brief, because I, after reading it, I realized that that was probably not the way that it should have been presented. I put an appendix that shows several pages from the records and says which defendant's exhibits and which state's exhibits they come from. Because the defendant's exhibits are actually the hard copy of the state's exhibits, because they introduced them by CD, and I'm just old school and I want to look at the documents. But it's in looking at those, you can see that the information is the same with some additions and modifications. And there's also testimony from Detective Martin in terms of cross-examination in the bill and in the objections that I made initially to the trial court. I really specifically delineate exactly what the differences were, what the additions were. Essentially, what it comes down to, though, I think to answer your question, hopefully more succinctly, is they got call detail records that showed who called what, where, and from where. For all phone numbers that were in the original motion to suppress search warrant issues that were litigated. And then when the USC warrants came, they didn't get them for all the ones they got originally, because they were only intending to admit a few of those numbers.
Well, back to the numbers, but still the original motion to suppress hearing covering all the same three developed numbers that were already developed as a consequence of responses to the form search warrant.
Absolutely, and that's why I argue that it's true, poison is true. Thank you.
If I have a question, please, I can just clarify. If the cell phone records were not admissible, does that leave only Madden's testimony against Brian?
Yes. And even the state says that. The cell phone records, well, the state says the cell phone records corroborate the defendant's statements, but Brian's statement is, I didn't do anything. So the only testimony that supports Madden's guilt, or excuse me, that supports Brian's guilt is Madden's. There's no physical evidence. There's no, absent the cell phone records, which I don't say support his guilt, because phone records don't show who's using the phone. And I think that's a really important factor here. It scares me that we're doing this. But they don't show who's using the phone. But yes, without the cell phone records, there is no cooperation of Madden's testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ready to hear from the state?
Okay, please support counsel. Counsel goes to great lengths to try to separate as to the voir dire issue, what occurred before the closure and what occurred subsequently in the bill that the council raised. I've recently listened to a very similar issue, oral argument in the case of Stedman that I've cited in my brief. In that oral argument, the appellant made an argument that the court should not rely on what the judge later said in his findings as to a very similar closure during the voir dire of family members. We don't have that order yet, but it appeared to me from that argument that the judges were thinking, well, of course we can consider that. It's like when we sent things back for findings. This was the appellant's bill. Things were presented. I think under the reasoning that I'm pretty sure we're going to hear is coming out soon. In this case, seven, that we're going to be able to consider what happened during the bill. And during the bill, the trial court identified the overriding interest. He said it would be extremely dangerous to have defendant friends and families and parties anywhere other than in the gallery. Also, in Lincoln Presley, the judge in this case heard arguments from both parties about alternative seating and accepted the defense's cases on the subject before he even made the ruling. His actions supported that he considered seating family members in the jury box to decide against doing so.
You're talking, I don't know if audience, you're talking about a case that was heard in the Court of Criminal Appeals?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Said in the state, it's been heard, it's been orally argued, the decision has not come down yet.
Are the oral arguments available online?
I didn't find them online. I had to call the court and get a copy for $5.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, and as discussed in Gupta, the exclusion was too trivial to implicate the Sixth Amendment. Gupta said, he made a point of saying that it wasn't a harm analysis that they were doing in that case. He said they weren't looking at whether the defendant was prejudiced by the closure. Instead, they were looking at whether his Sixth Amendment rights were violated. And that sentiment is supported in Waller, where the United States Supreme Court said that the need for an open proceeding might vary in strength depending on the phase of trial.
Were any members of the public excluded? Were the doors locked?
There's not evidence that the doors were locked. I think it was specific as to the two family members, one friend, and the victim's family.
You implied that Boyd Dyer might not be an important part of the trial.
I think it's important, Your Honor, but I also think some of the things, and this is what Gupta set out. They said there are certain things that we need to protect the Sixth Amendment rights. It's to ensure a fair trial, to remind the prosecutor and judge of their responsibility to the accused and the importance of their functions, to encourage witnesses to come forward, and to discourage perjury. And it noted that at least for the last two of those, just any time you had a four-jar, those rights aren't going to be implicated. You've got a room full of people. It's not technically closed, if you think about it. You've got a room full of impartial people. So it protects some of those rights. And then it found out that under the facts of those cases, which are very similar to the facts of this case, that the rights were not implicated.
It seems to me that the selection of the decision makers is about as important as anything that's going to go on during the trial.
Well, Your Honor, as they noted in Waller, that when they were discussing that case involved the, I believe it was a suppression hearing, and they made a point in Waller of saying, well, this is especially important because we're interviewing witnesses, they just seemed to me to create some kind of distinction there between levels of importance. Your Honor, I was not there, but I certainly would expect so. Just a minute. I believe that was all part of the interview. As I understand, the counsel is actually there. I was not.
In terms of after the jury was picked to see, then there was fucking room for the courtroom.
And everything is open after the court. I'd also like to address what counsel said about the phone records being the fruit of the poisonous tree. Counsel made his objections to phone records, appellant's old phone records to his old phone, which really didn't have much to do with this trial, if anything. Counsel also refers to Danny's phone numbers, who do have some importance to this. First, I would ask this court to look at the cell records. The warrants in those cell records, I think, are valid, supported by probable cause. But even so, even if you find that they weren't, here all we've got, even if you think that those phone records were illegal fruit, all we have is Day's records, really, that matter under this situation. And if you look at the victim's records that are not under that argument, they say so many of the same things. They show that the last phone calls were made between the victim and between the appellant. They show the traveling of the phone going from the murder scene. Yes, Your Honor.
What do these records show is connections between the two appellants and the site of this problem.
You're right, Your Honor, and I shouldn't say
that. And there was no development of the content of the telephone messages, was there?
What was in the messages?
There was no evidence about the content of the message. It was only led through the peaking device of the telephone towers. There was a location or when phones were being used in close locations.
As I understand it.
And then there was some testimony about, I called on this number to that number from the command.
Yes, sir.
And that's all.
And it's
I'm sorry.
And,
tax on that property, that's the ultimate part of the, of what, when you say it, with first evidence that the last phone call I made.
Was from that number to that number, right?
You're talking about from the number to the number, not who made the call, who's on the phone.
Yes, sir, you're correct.
All right.
Is circumstantial evidence sufficient for cooperation?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And we also, counsel says that that's all the evidence we have. We have the appellant admitting to Madden in slang terms that he shot him. And if you don't want to just rely on Madden, Madden's girlfriend and another, Tremaine Stanberry, was somehow involved in the phone call the next day when they were all trying to find out what happened.
My understanding was interested in what happened to the marijuana that he supplied.
Some do, but he also stated.
Dawson to take over and make a sale.
Yes, Your Honor, but he also stated he was worried about.
So I have a concern about cooperation because Madden is a possible accomplice according to the testimony of the defendant.
I believe there was accomplice witness instruction in the jury charge.
Okay.
And also Madden got up and Madden testified. And the jurors got to see his credibility. They got to see Stanberry's credibility, Madden's girlfriend, and a lot of people got up to testify. And I think that unless there are any other questions, I'll conclude and ask this court to affirm the decision to talk about below.
Thank you.
I have one quick question.
Yes, Your Honor.
On page 2 of your brief, you say, Pellett told Perry the man who things were supposed to go right and they went left, or that the deal went left. Mitch got crazy and I hit the hole 9 times and I let off 6 and he stayed in the chain. Now, notice it said, Pellett also told Madden. Is Perry also there? The sentence before you say, Pellett told Perry and Madden.
I think the record just shows that statement was made. I don't think we have confirmation from the girlfriend that was said. I just think that's attributable. And it may have been in a later phone call.
That's something he didn't tell the detective in the first part of the investigation. He came out only weeks before trial.
Oh, I didn't call that. Okay.
But that didn't happen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Four, you have a shot?
I do, Your Honor. I also listened to the Stetson tapes, and one of the things that the court was interested in there, in that particular case, was that case actually occurred before Presley. I think that there was also some concern about whether or not the trial court would recognize that law would apply in four dire proceedings, although I think there's precedence to support that. I'm not saying that we don't consider what the judge said in the record. I mean, it's not like the Stetson case where we abated it back and then they got findings from the judge, you know, however many years later. I'm not saying don't consider it. What I'm saying is the best evidence is what he said that he didn't. You know, the fact that when we make suggestions about, well, we could have done this, we could have done this, and he says, well, I think that's dangerous, in light of those suggestions, doesn't show that he took the affirmative action of articulating for the record what it was that he considered before he shut the courtroom doors. And that's what I think is important about that. Also, with regard to the Fenner panel being there, yes, they're members of the public, but when they come in to the courtroom in order to be questioned, to be jurors in the case, they become part of the system. If we were going to say that just having the Fenner panel in there, in the courtroom, was sufficient to protect the public's right of openness and to observe trials, then Waller, Press, none of the cases would have been an issue about whether or not the public was there, because the Fenner panel is always there, or the jury is always there. And so if we're saying that those persons are still retaining their status as members of the public rather than becoming part of the system, we wouldn't have to find any sort of error in any of these cases. So I don't think that we can say that. I don't want to talk too much about the triviality because I did talk about it a lot in the reply brief, but as to the cell records, I do want to note that not only did the cell records show what the locations were supposedly, but those locations were wrong. And I didn't get to ask Martin about that. Because if you look at the cell tower data, you will see that the cell towers that were supposedly used at the time of most important time, when they're saying that the phone records were pinging near the defendant's house. Those cell towers were not in existence at the time of the original calls in 2009.
It is in
my bill with regard to Martin, and I'm sorry I can't get my brief and tell you the exact page numbers, but it's in my bill with regard to Martin. It's in the actual documents and examining the documents. It's my argument to the court about why it is that I should be able under 705 to cross-examine the detective about the discrepancies in those. It's also in the written trial objections that I filed and in the arguments about the case.
Towers that were identified by the records that were obtained on the federal statute. Towers close to that located a cell phone in use when the number should be crossed without close to the home of Mr. Harrison Dallas were not in existence at the time.
Cell tower 171, repole 21.
How could they pick up phone call wasn't in existence?
The records that were generated were in 2010. It goes back to my whole argument about the records. The problem is we didn't have somebody from Sprint here saying how these records worked. So in 2009, they had a set of records that show, okay, these are the cell towers in existence and 171's not on there. And then when you get to the 2010 records,
thank you both. living, and he'll have an opinion of where it is in the next few months. And we will excuse you, and we're going to recess for about 7 minutes. 10 minutes. Let's recess for 10 minutes.